This is The Think Tank, talking about the major economic, political, and social issues of the week. On the Voice of Arizona, News Talk 92.3, KTAR, here's Dr. Mike O'Neill and Mike Russell.
Biggest political upset of the year. Eric Cantor goes down in flames. Who is he? Or perhaps the better question is, who was he? Well, if you don't recognize the name, Eric Cantor was the number two guy in the U.S. House of Representatives. And my personal bet, and I think most of the smart money, was that had he not lost his primary this week, come next January, he would have been Speaker of the House. There was rumblings amongst the more conservative members of the House that perhaps John Boehner wasn't conservative enough for him, and that Eric Cantor was next in line and likely to take over. But that's not going to happen. He got beat by nobody. He had $5 million. He got beat by an opponent with a couple of hundred thousand, previously unheard of economics professor at a local school. And we have with us one of the representatives of one of the great political prognosticating empires in America. Kyle Condick is the managing editor of Larry Sabato's Crystal Ball, which is there, not only does national stuff, but happens to be down the street from Eric Cantor's home district. He is at the University of Virginia. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Well, I love the way you ended your article on this that I read in Politico the other day. Take a deep breath. This may not be it clearly astounded everybody, but give us quickly your take. What happened and why?
Well, I think it's always pretty surprising when really any incumbent member of the House or the Senate not just loses, but loses the nomination of his or her own party. Just to put this in perspective, Eric Cantor was denied renomination by his own party. He is only one of two members of the House this year who have sought renomination and did not receive it. So 227 of 229 House incumbents this year ran for renomination and won. And so then this typically happens, you'll have a handful of members of the House lose renomination every year, but really it's every year it's only, 1 to 2% of the members, if that. Going back to the end of World War II, just 2% of members who sought another term actually lost their own party's nomination. And so this happens, but it doesn't happen all that often, and it certainly doesn't happen to the House Majority Leader since the creation of the position right around the turn of the 1899. No House Majority Leader had ever lost renomination in his own party primary. So it was a huge shock, but it also doesn't necessarily mean that we're seeing this big wave of incumbents getting kicked out of office.
Yeah, well, leadership has not been immune, though, haven't they? I mean, I'm thinking Tom Foley was Speaker of the House.
Sure.
I'm thinking Tom Daschle was, I believe, Senate Majority Leader.
Yeah, Tom Foley, who was from Washington State, was the Speaker of the House. He lost in the general election in the big Republican wave of 1994. Tom Daschle, the Senate Minority Leader, he was Senate Majority Leader from, I think, 2000 to 2002, and then he lost in 2004 in the general election. More recently, Harry Reid up in Nevada came very close to losing in 2010, and Mitch McConnell, the Senate Minority Leader in Kentucky, has a very tough election coming up. And so one theory I sort of had about this was that I think sometimes when you're in a position of power in Congress, I think maybe at a certain point, the people in your home district or home state think that maybe you've become sort of more of a national figure than a local one. And I think that's sort of a different different viewpoint in politics, because I think the historic tradition was that, you wanted as a citizen, you wanted a lawmaker who became a national figure and who had good committee assignments or rose up the ranks of leadership, so basically they could exercise more power on behalf of the district or the state. But voters may not be thinking about it that way anymore.
Now, you mentioned that there was not going to be a flood of incumbents losing their seats or their primaries. What does this do to the incumbents? What message does this send to those that are seeking re-election?
One of the things that sort of trickled out after Cantor lost is that he probably didn't have a very good constituent service operation, meaning, you know, if you call your congressman for, you know, if you're a veteran and you need to get some sort of VA issue handled, or, you know, some just sort of the run of the mill stuff that people go to their member of Congress for, supposedly his operation was not very good. And I think that's the one way where people actually deal with their member of Congress on a day-to-day basis. And so if that's poor, as I think maybe it was in Cantor's case, over the years you sort of upset some people, and I think at a certain point you end up losing if there are other factors that hurt you, and I think that's sort of what happened with Cantor. And so the lesson I think that the people should take is not necessarily that the Tea Party is making these, you know, ideological or is pushing everyone to the right and is going to knock out people if they're not ideologically poor. I think the message more is simpler than that, in that if you want to keep winning a re-election, you have to run a good constituent services operation, and you have to be in the district a little bit more, and maybe if you have national ambitions, to sort of tamp that down a little bit.
So you think it was more of an anti-Cantor vote than a pro-Tea Party vote?
I do. Since the loss, we've just heard from people in that district, and again, this is all kind of anecdotal. You know, there was some polling of the district, but the polling was very bad. It showed most. You know, there were a few polls, and Cantor was up, in the 50s or even the low 60s, which I think is one of the reasons why I think everyone, including myself, thought that Cantor would win, even though, or you know, maybe not do particularly as well as he did previously, but that he would still win. And of course, I was wrong, and many others were wrong.
I think everybody was wrong. Nobody called this one.
Yeah, I don't think anybody called this. I don't think anybody called this one. In fact, I think, you know, I think Bratt himself, David Bratt, the guy who beat Eric Cantor, you know, I think on election night he expressed a fair amount of surprise too. And hey, you know, good for him. I mean, he pulled off one of the great recent upsets in American political history.
And that's Kyle Condit. He's the managing editor of Sabato's Crystal Ball. We're gonna keep you around if we could, because I want to stay on this, and we want to bring in Bob Grossfeld as well. He's our local political guru. More of this next, right here on the Think Tank News Talk 92.3 KTAR.
You're listening to The Think Tank on the Voice of Arizona, News Talk 92.3 KTAR.
We're here with Kyle Condit, managing editor of Sabato's Crystal Ball, one of the most astute vehicles for understanding American politics out there. And I believe The Price is Right. How do you get on that list?
So The Price is Right. It is free. If you just go to centerforpolitics.org/crystalball, you can sign up for our newsletter, which comes out every Thursday. And, of course, I'm on Twitter at K Kondik, KKONDIK, and my boss, Larry Sabato, is on there at Larry Sabato.
And you could probably find it if you missed all that and just Googled Larry Sabato, S-A-B-A-T-O, you probably get there. In addition to being national prognosticators, you happen to be sitting down the street from this district. You're at the University of Virginia. I wonder if you had any other thoughts from a local perspective on what did Eric Cantor do wrong? You mentioned inattention to local issues and constituent service. Any other observations you'd like to make that might have escaped us here who are not in town there?
You know, I do think that there probably also was an ideological component to this. Cantor, I think that there was some kind of maybe, you know, people you would describe as maybe supporters of the Tea Party, maybe sort of more conservative members of the Republican Party who don't really like the House Republican leadership and Speaker John Boehner and, of course, their local congressman, Eric Cantor, the House Majority Leader. And so when the House Republican caucus sort of got tied up in the shutdown last fall, and basically it was killing Republicans in the polls, and they basically made a big strategic mistake in pursuing it. But when that whole thing fell apart, I think Cantor sort of looked bad, and I think also some members of the GOP who were sort of the more conservative people thought they should keep the shutdown going, that they shouldn't have basically folded. And then also there's been talk of maybe doing immigration reform, and immigration reform is something that obviously, as you all know, being out in Arizona is a really hot-button issue, particularly amongst conservatives. And Cantor, I mean, I wouldn't even really describe him as a really full-throated supporter of doing doing immigration reform, but his name has sort of been bandied about as someone who, you know, may want to do this basically to for the future of the Republican Party, and I think that also became sort of problematic. And so
my read of that is that he just opened the door a tiny crack that he might be open to some kind of a deal.
Yeah, that's right.
And that was enough to set off the right.
Well, and you know, I really think that the immigration issue is really one on the Republican side that really they just don't want immigration reform as it's been laid out by the president, and I think even whenever you, as a Republican, sort of get even tangentially close to that issue, you're in trouble. And I just remember, you know, when Rick Perry was the presidential frontrunner for a time in fall of 2011, if you'll recall, he had that debate where he talked about how people who, there was a Texas Dream Act, basically, and he said that basically if people who don't like that idea don't have a heart. And, man, I think that was a really bad thing for Perry. Now, granted, Perry made a lot of other mistakes, but I look at that as one of the key moments of the start of his fall. And so that's just the way things are in the GOP. But, again, I don't think that immigration explains Cantor's loss. I think it's one little piece of a bigger picture.
One other issue.
Sorry to interrupt. One other issue is that Cantor had a lot of money to spend, and he spent very aggressively against David Brat, his opponent. And you, typically, the conventional wisdom has been that if you're a Republican who loses a primary, you got caught off guard. You didn't take it seriously enough. I think it's possible that Cantor actually took it like too seriously, in that he put out these attack ads against David Brat that I think maybe sort of backfired. In fact, Brat himself said that he thought that Cantor putting out attack ads against him and actually naming him in the ads actually helped his name ID quite significantly, to the point where I think it's possible that some people who didn't really know who Brat was but saw the attack ads and knew they didn't like Cantor, that the attack didn't register, but David Brat's name registered with them. And so I think just strategically the Cantor campaign made a lot of mistakes, even though they did spend a lot of money.
Now, with Cantor stepping down as the House Majority Leader, is that sour grapes or is that strategery by the Republican Party?
I think that there was really no point in him staying as a lame duck House Majority Leader, and I think that the party just wanted to get this leadership vote out of the way real quick. In fact, it's coming up next week, I believe. And also, I'm sure that Eric Cantor would like for Kevin McCarthy of California, who is the who's the third ranking member in the House behind Cantor and Boehner as the majority whip. I think that he would like to hand the office off to McCarthy. There may be some more kind of outsider conservatives in the House Republican caucus who would prefer the job to go to somebody else. By doing the vote quickly, they may be allowing McCarthy to sort of consolidate his support and win the position before others can run a good campaign for it.
Okay, let's back off of Cantor. Let's take a broader view. What does this say? What's the future of the Tea Party? What's their power in this country?
Well, I think the Tea Party is going to continue to sort of operate as a check on Republicans, but also just as a it's a force within the Republican Party pulling the party to the right. And it's not really anything new. You can trace the Tea Party back to really Arizona, Barry Goldwater, and beyond that, in terms of there's always been this kind of push-pull in the party between, I would call, kind of the D.C. establishment, which I think is represented by somebody like Cantor, and then sort of the outsiders, which is the Tea Party, but it's also the same forces that made Barry Goldwater the Republican presidential nominee 50 years ago. It's the same thing. It sort of manifests itself in different ways. But this is this push and pull in the GOP has been there for a long time, and I think is going to continue.
Of course, back in the days of Goldwater, there actually was a liberal wing of the Republican Party. We had Rockefellers and Percys and Jake Javits and folks
sure.
like that. I want to bring in Bob Grossfeld to get your reaction. Let's start with the Tea Party. What's its future as you see it?
Well, I think it's clearly, in essence, it's the right wing of the Republican Party. Calling it the Tea Party, in a way, is kind of a misnomer.
But it was good branding, wasn't it?
Oh, it's great branding. And I think it goes back, and Kyle, I'd be curious into, you know, your thoughts about that. But to me, it dates back to the John Birch Society. And before that, back to 19th century economics.
Well, John Birch's side, Koch brothers' dad was involved, and their money was behind establishing that.
Exactly. And, you know, when in, when was it, 2004, when we first started hearing about the Tea Party, I think at that point it really was a local grassroots kind of phenomena. And then when Dick Armey essentially jumped ahead of it with his organization and now the Koch brothers, it's become institutionalized and is now the right wing of the Republicans.
I think that's right. I mean, I think that the, you know, probably the Birchers would have some sort of role in it. But one thing I would say about the Tea Party is I think that when it first sort of that term sort of first started being used, people thought of it almost as like a third party movement or a distinct. A group distinct from the Republican Party, and like I really don't think it is. I mean, I think it's just the more conservative wing of the Republican Party, or it's the less DC wing of the Republican Party. At least the grassroots is now, as you say, like somebody like Dick Armey gets involved in it, and you know Dick Armey is about as DC as you can get.
All right. Well, Kyle,
he was at the time, so you know that's a part of it. But I think that the people who would identify as Tea Party are not. Not the DC types, at least sort of the voters who would.
Kyle Condon, he's the managing editor of Sabato's Crystal Ball. Thank you so much for joining us. We have more right up next on the Think Tank, News Talk 92.3 KTAR.
You're listening to the Think Tank on the Voice of Arizona, News Talk 92.3 KTAR.
We're here now with local political guru and prognosticator of all things political, Bob Grossfeld. We have been talking about the demise of Eric Cantor, the implications for the Tea Party. And Bob, I want to ask you, okay, what does this say for Arizona? And can you think of any races in Arizona where there might be a reverberation of what happened this week?
Well, I think the big reverberation, if you will, is that in Arizona, they're all Tea Party, or they're fighting to become the carrying the mantle of Tea Party. And there's a fight to the right. And so I don't think necessarily to tag somebody as Tea Party or not Tea Party is, at least in Arizona, is something of a useless exercise.
Well, there's one race that comes to my mind. I want to ask you about this. That's Andrew Tobin. He was in the leadership in the House. He is clearly being flanked on the far right by two opponents who are trying to, you know, basically the same kind of argument that he was too establishment, that he played ball with the governor, and we're much more angry than that.
Yeah, and I think the difference, if you want to draw one between what happened with Cantor and what it seems to be happening with Tobin, is Cantor was more than willing to go, you know, and I'm as right wing as you are, and I'm anti-establishment. At least that's what he was saying on
evidently
the
not
there.
Enough.
Not enough. Tobin is trying to do the same thing, and I think he's just pretty inept at trying to pull it off.
You think he's in trouble?
Oh, I think he's definitely in trouble.
So where else? Do you see any other races, or is this just, you know, does this just say the Tea Party is going to be around?
Well, again, if you assume Tea Party as an organization.
Well, it never was. It was an idea. It was a flag to burnish. It was something to motivate a group,
I think,
that has always been a force within the Republican Party. This is a galvanizing phrase.
Exactly. And so if you're looking for the Tea Party, you're probably not going to find it other than on websites. If you're looking for the far right conservative, you're going to find it everywhere around here.
Republican precinct meetings all over Arizona.
All over Arizona.
Well, this does show, when you go back to Eric Cantor, when I talk about reverberations, if we're going to keep it right here in Arizona, it does, I would think, as a political strategist, as someone that's running for office on a Republican ticket, that has to be in the back of my mind at all times, that I probably will have to play at some level to the far right of my party.
Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
And I don't think that's new in Arizona. I think that's been the trend for some time. As our essentially as our primary system has been taken over by gerrymandered districts. And so now you have districts all over the place that are being decided by primaries.
Right.
And it's a fight to the right.
In maybe about four congressional districts and most of the legislative districts.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And if it's always been that way, is anyone going to change their strategy? Do you think of anyone off the top of your head that's, well, now, wait a second, I'm going to have to change?
Not anybody in particular, but I can tell you what I think the tactical change has to be. They're not going to be able to win with an air war of bombarding a given district or even the state with a whole lot of radio and a whole lot of television. It is going to be a ground game now that wins.
Wow. And that was a ground game that beat Cantor.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Coupled with social media.
Moving to the Arizona gubernatorial race, does that suggest that Doug Ducey, a pile of money but not a lot of grassroots history, this doesn't bode well for him? Is that the implication?
I think that may be the case at this point. Right now, they're running up to the point where early ballots are going to be going out. The vote by mail is going to be going out for the primary. And so he may have a leg up simply because his name ID is going through the roof because he's spending a whole lot of money now. And you get guys like Ken Bennett, who presumably should be well known because he's been an office holder as Secretary of State prior to that Senate president, is nowhere to be found. Christine Jones is probably number two to Ducey. And then you have the second and third tier that are just completely unknown.
That was Scott Smith.
Scott Smith is one that is coming up. Mm-hmm. He is well known, I think, within the Valley, probably not statewide. And I don't think he's defined himself yet, and which is part of the name ID phenomenon. You have to not only be known, but you have to be known as something. And I don't think Scott has yet defined himself as something yet.
You think any of these guys are playing the grassroots, though? I mean, Ducey's on the air. Christine Jones is on the air.
I have not seen any evidence of a grassroots organization other than they're using mail. And that's about as grassroots as things seem to be at this point. Not seeing a whole lot of walking and a whole lot of phone calling, a lot of setting up precinct structures. But that could all be below the radar for all I know.
Somebody can win with 23% of the vote in a split primary.
You got how many? Seven people running?
Yeah. And four or five of some credible stature.
Yeah. It's going to be a tough race. But I think with the gubernatorial race here in the state of Arizona that it isn't. It isn't a far right push. Although you did say that the Tea Party's been around. Tea Party's in every race here in Arizona. But I would think, at least for the gubernatorial race here, that it seems to be a race to center right. Am I far off on that?
Yeah, I think so. Only because for this purpose, if you set aside ideology and look at who's going to get their people out to vote, that's where the Tea Party, that's where those extremes, both right and left, come into play. In this case, on the right, their turnout factor is enormous. And that's what will determine who wins.
The thing that I see in the commercials that we've seen though far, what just has me scratching my head, though not really because I know why it is a prominent feature is always, I'm going to fight Obama. Now, what that has to do with being governor of Arizona, of a guy who's on his way out, I don't know. I know what it does in terms of reveling up the Republican base, however. So you know why they're doing it, though. I'm scratching my head in terms of what a governor would do with, in effect, a lame duck president.
It's dog whistle politics. Yeah. Blow the whistle, they get all excited.
Right. And I'll tell you, as someone, I'm a registered Republican, it turns me off. It makes me roll my eyes because it doesn't seem to have any substance. And like you said, Doc, you're running against someone that's leaving office and you're not. It has nothing to do with your job description unless you want to wag a finger on the tarmac.
I think Bob said it. Yes, like wagging your finger. It's dog whistle. It doesn't have anything to do with politics. I mean, what am I going to do? Not take federal money? It doesn't mean anything. There's no, frankly, and we're dealing now with a Congress that I think is guaranteed to be in a state of complete inaction for the next 2 years.
Well, are you dealing with? Okay, but on a federal level.
On a federal level. They're not going to. We're gridlock, ultra gridlock.
I want to ask Bob on a state level with the gubernatorial race, on the state level, working with the state legislature, and we spoke with a few of the candidates last week. I kept asking the question, how do you wrangle a group that is historically has a full-time job of making Arizona look bad? How do you work with them and stop the nonsense and get to work?
Well, the formula, if you will, for important things has been you throw it out to the legislature, controlled by the Republicans in both houses. They beat it up and they deny the governor whatever it is she or presumably he wants. And then they have to go shopping with the Democrats in order to build a coalition, in order to get anything done. And that's not unusual in Arizona. Mm-hmm. There's a history of that going back many years where Alfredo Gutierrez was a minority leader in the state Senate, and they talked about having to go shop at Alfredo's store mm-hmm. in order to get the votes to get anything done.
Wow. Yeah, it's definitely a formula that they're going to have to master, at least in this election, at least if somebody's going to be asking them the right questions instead of, where do you stand on Obama?
The difference is the context in which that's occurring right now is an extremely bifurcated, very, very polarized electorate and party, much more so than the Alfredo days.
All right, Doc and I wrapping a bow on this show when we get back to the think tank right here on News Talk 92.3 KTAR.
You're listening to The Think Tank on the Voice of Arizona, News Talk 92.3 KTAR.
Believe it or not, Doc O'Neill doesn't just spend 1 hour a week on the radio. He's got a day job, too. You can check him out at MikeO'Neill.org or O'NeillResearch.com for the latest in marketing and public research and opinion, blogs, articles, op-eds, and videos. And, that's right, and an archive of our very own think tanks.
Every show we've ever done.
Check it out. Oh, my goodness. We're coming up on a year. Have we passed a year yet?
We're past a year, yeah.
We're past a year. Yeah. Well, all right. Well, happy belated anniversary,
you're number two.
How about that? Check that out. Look at us.
Buy me a cake.
We beat the over-under. Check us out. All right. We talked about Eric Cantor a little bit. We talked about the reverberations of that that primary here locally. But let's jump back nationally if we could, Doc. I want to talk about the how this impacts the Republican leadership on a national level.
I think, number one, the immigration issue is dead. I don't think anybody suggests this is the reason that Cantor went down, but one of the things in the mix was he seemed to, at some point, he opened the door a tiny crack that maybe as part of the leadership he would be involved in brokering a deal, and even that came back to haunt him.
Is that what squashed him?
No. Okay. I think it was just in the mix. But then we have what's going on at the border right now, all the kids that are coming through. That and this thing with Cantor, I think, have put the final nails in the coffin. There will be no dealing with the immigration issue this year by Congress.
Now, I'm looking at it from a different angle because I bought into a little bit of the Cantor's gone. Okay, we got immigration reform is squashed at this point. The Tea Party seems to be very anti any type of reform. But then I see the influx, the issue that we're dealing with right now on our very own border, and I think that won't let it go away. In my opinion, it's if you're on one side of the argument, you're on the amnesty for everybody, or you're on the build a wall and bust them all out of here, both camps are agreeing on this one issue.
We have a problem.
We have a big problem. Something needs to happen. If fixing nothing else, let's fix ABC that we see in front of us right now, and that's what you call compromise and reform, right?
Well, you know, I wish you were right. I really do.
How am I wrong?
I think that you're right in that it makes that issue front and center, but it not only has to be salient, which it clearly is, we have to have some basis for a deal. And I think the latest flood of kids going to the border I just see people digging in their heels. I see if anybody and on a national level might have played with the idea of trying to present something in the way of a deal, that would be a Jeb Bush, maybe even a Marco Rubio. I just see them terrified by what happened to Cantor, even though immigration was one of maybe 10 things that sunk him, but it's on the list. And I just see sides with their heels dug in, and there's no way I see anything this year. I would be surprised if we see anything on this next year, frankly.
I don't think they can bounce around it. And here's why I say that. Right here at KTAR, our newsroom is flooded by news organizations from around the country. And this happened just over the last few days from around the country asking about this. This has become a very large national story right in a primary season across the country. I think it's going to stay on the forefront. I don't think you could dance around it. How do you do that?
Huge.
As a politician, how do you say, I'm going to hide, I'm going to bury my head in the sand over here and not address the one issue everyone's talking about?
The problem is I think you do anything other than mass deportations, and the right says amnesty. And so I have to see what's the basis of a deal.
Sure.
And that's I absolutely agree with you. This is a big issue that just got bigger because of the recent, you know, wave of kids and others coming through, not from Mexico now, so much as Central America.
And that's making people's head explode, by the way, because they a lot of people can't wrap their head around the fact that these aren't just Mexicans jumping a wall. Like, okay, we'll deal with that eventually.
They're coming
a bigger wall.
Thousands of miles.
Yeah.
They're coming through Mexico.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. So this seems like this is where it becomes, in a lot of people's eyes that aren't on the front lines like we are here in Arizona, this is where it becomes a humanitarian issue. You have a visual of now going across a continent and just for an opportunity to be here.
And you're
in the
not
United
just
States.
Talking people who are trying to better themselves economically. A lot of those folks are under physical threat. And so there's that raises the stakes in terms of the humanitarian side.
And now to stay away from the politics, I want to get your read on this. We spoke on Thursday. We spoke to the ACLU. That filed a 25-page complaint against the Border Patrol, claiming a variety of things. And it has very little to do with the current problems that we see, the flooding from South America. We're talking rape, abuse, I wouldn't say torture. I mean, but people being held in cages.
Yeah.
It's absolutely horrific. The first thing I thought of, and I want your opinion on this, first thing I thought of was this has all the makings of the next big federal scandal. We saw the VA, and that started with peeling one little piece of the onion away, and then boom. Yeah. Now, do we have the same thing on our hands?
I think, as near as I can tell, and all the facts certainly aren't in, but that the border folks just got overwhelmed by the flood. And I think that's why people got sent here.
This report, though, and speaking to the ACLU, this report goes back further than just this flood. This seems to be a systemic problem all along the border. And this is the last thing we need right now.
Really, really scary stuff. And, I mean, I think it's stuff that internationally portends to not make us look in a pretty good light.
Right. Now, but go ahead, Bob.
Well, I think, just to jump in between the two of you guys, I think one of the things you're going to start seeing is an enormous amount of pressure being put on whoever is left in Congress to do something. Mm-hmm. And it might be very minor. It might be as simple as to stop the mass deportations, either by congressional action or clearly by the administration, which has control over that. The Obama administration has done more mass deportations than any other administration in recent history.
Right.
And they can stop that. And that begins to at least show some movement towards immigration reform, which is what those who are clamoring for it need to see.
But I think Doc O'Neill brought up the point that if the Obama administration were to do that, the right would immediately, he's getting amnesty. He's breaking the law.
Probably
get out the pitchforks.
Oh, absolutely. I think the difference is he can get away with it.
Yeah, I guess you get the point.
He's run his last campaign.
Well, I think the difference is administratively the president can do a lot of things. In order for Congress to do something, you need to get a majority, maybe even a supermajority. And I see both sides so dug in. I don't see any
deal. Reality is, and we've known this for a long time, if it were allowed to come to a vote in the House, it would pass, period. And we've known that. Cantor knew that, which is why he wouldn't let it come to the floor.
Yeah, because it'd be most all the Democrats and a handful of Republicans, but they have this majority of a majority rule that you don't bring it to to vote.
Right, but here's how we bring that around, though, in talking about the ACLU, and it's not a lawsuit, it's just a complaint at this point that will obviously evolve to a lawsuit. Now we have public opinion, because the story is coast to coast, what's going on our borders right now, the story is coast to coast. Then we have, now it enters the courts, and going back to our election cycle that we're in right now, they've got to intersect. All of them have to intersect at some point, and it'll probably come to a head probably fall right before the election. I think some movement will happen. It's just what I'm seeing.
Again, I come back administratively. You know, the president can act on his own and do a number of things. Mm-hmm. He's got a certain amount of latitude. Congress, I mean, I'll take that bet. I don't see him doing anything.
Really? Okay.
I just, you know, unless John Boehner wants to fall on his sword and say, listen, I'm on my way out. I'm going to bring this thing to a vote, knowing full well that in January I'm out of a job, that, you know, that my own caucus will vote me out, which I think they were going to do anyway.
Well, or unless the Republican autopsy that they did after the last election proved to be true.
Right.
And we see in the November elections, a mass uprising by Latino voters in those areas where there are a lot of Latino voters.
So does it, if it were to, let's say, forget if can it or it can't happen, let's say someone waved a wand and immigration reform happened. Does that resurrect the Republican Party? Does that even help? Are they barking up the wrong tree?
Well, if you have that happen, I think you've got some disgruntled people on the right who are going to be furious. It'll be going, they'll eat their own, you know, and the issue doesn't go away.
Bob?
I think the thing to bear in mind is every single poll done by either side shows that the vast majority of Americans, including the majority of Republicans, support comprehensive immigration reform.
Mm-hmm.
It is this one sliver in Congress that has been preventing it.
And those guys vote in Republican primaries, ask Eric Kander.
Absolutely.
The great savior, Ronald Reagan. He was all about it, too, but no one likes to talk about that, do they?
He did real amnesty.
Yes, he did. Holy mackerel, he did amnesty. Thank you to our guest, Kyle Condick, and thank you to Bob Grossfeld as well for being here. I'm Mike Russell. He's Dr. Mike O'Neill. Thanks for spending some time right here in the Think Tank on News Talk 92.3 KTAR.